Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, and I'm your host for Sea Control North America. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Maddie Keller, a graduate student at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, who is researching the self-education of Abraham Lincoln. During our discussion, we examine how Lincoln taught himself to be a military leader, how a first lieutenant's thoughts remade the Union Army, and how reading a map led to the destruction of a Confederate ironclad. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Maddie Keller of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Maddie, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be here.
As is Sea Control tradition, please, Maddie, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background and what brings you here today.
Of course. So my name is Matthew Keller. I'm a second-year grad student at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy here in Medford. I'm concentrating in international security studies and the United States, and I'm currently just finishing up my capstone piece on the self-education of a wartime commander-in-chief, Abraham Lincoln. Before I came here, I was an officer in the U.S. Navy for 5 years. I was stationed in the West Coast on a frigate, the USS Vandegrift, and also on the East Coast with Riverine Squadron 3. Before that, I went to the Naval Academy, and I was an engineer. I wasn't a diplomat or kind of arts and sciences guy, but I was a systems engineer, not a Civil War expert by any means, more of a Revolutionary War guy. I grew up just down the road in Concord, Massachusetts, right next to the Old North Bridge, and I'm super pumped for Patriots Day coming up. And also, just a little tidbit, this is something we kind of recently rediscovered. My family descends from a veteran of the Battle of Bunker Hill. So I'm a ninth generation direct descendant of son of the American Revolution. So I'm loving the Civil War study, but full disclosure, I'm all about the Revolutionary War.
So as a brief thing for our audience, so a capstone is essentially another way of saying a thesis where there's a little bit more kind of flexibility in terms of what it is that you're actually able to do. But of course, you went as a trained engineer, decided to go down the route where you do the most research and the most writing and the most stuff that probably has nothing to do with what you've ever done before.
Yeah, I mean, we use like a lot of different words for our capstone presentation, but I mean, it's in the format of a thesis, but it pales in comparison to the rigorous study and research requirements of a doctoral thesis. So I'm not one of those people just in the 2-year program here. So, but yeah, still very, very intimidating. And hopefully on this podcast, I can, talk to some of the listeners who, are like, hey, I've never done anything like this. Is it for me? And hopefully in a couple months, I'll be able to say, yes, it's possible because I have to do it to graduate. So we'll see.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your capstone topic. So obviously you mentioned self-education and Abraham Lincoln, but how did you stumble on that topic?
So I was taking a course that had a couple-week Civil War module in it with Professor Schultz called the War Course here. So we go through, Thucydides, Vietnam War, World War II, and we also do an American Civil War module. And there's one class about just over a year ago, actually, where, we're talking about the divide between the civilian and military leadership for the Union and just in governments at that time in the 19th century. And I remember, I was told, Lincoln got fed up with his generals and their poor performance. And so he sent someone to the Library of Congress to get him some books, and he read them, and then he stepped in. And I kind of, you know, went up to my professor, who's now my research advisor, and I asked him, what books did he read? It seemed kind of important, and I'd want to read those books. And I definitely had a very poignant moment that I can remember where he said, I don't know, Maddie. And I was like, ooh, I want to find out. So
it could be an aspiring capstone advisor says, I don't know something, you're like, ah, there
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, definitely if one of the angles we kind of pursue for this podcast is, you know, people who are trying to get into academic writing, I mean, that is a good indicator because there's a lot of, you know, minds and writers out there. Whenever an accomplished scholar says, I don't know, to a specific question, that's a great potential starting point. And then the last year has been a lot of work, but that was definitely a good practice to have that as a starting point.
So obviously, you know, Abraham Lincoln is a pretty big topic. And based off our discussions before, it is not just a big topic, but a hilariously big topic, especially when the subject of books comes up. Isn't that right?
So, you know, once I was pursuing this angle on what Lincoln read from the Library of Congress in the beginning of the Civil War and trying to figure that out, doing a lit review of the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln is no small task, as I quickly found out. There were four or five complete works, like complete secondary sources, on what Lincoln read. Some of the titles were, you know, Lincoln and His Books, Reading with Lincoln, What Lincoln Read, Here Are the Books That Lincoln Read, an exhaustive and annotated list of what Lincoln read. So just reading those titles, I was a little discouraged for my potential capstone topic. But delving into those, there was definitely a lack of consensus. And, I mean, that spans his entire life. And one of the first things you learn about Lincoln is from his early age, he's reading nonstop for the rest of his life, quite frankly. So there's definitely a lot of material there. And it once I kind of got over the, oh, my gosh, I might not be the first person to write about Abraham Lincoln. Once I kind of like hit myself on the head, I was reassured by the lack of consensus and, more importantly, the lack of work kind of talking about the importance of what he read. So I'm not just trying to catalog things, trying to make connections between his reading and policy.
How did you go about trying to establish sort of a causal link? And then we'll talk about what specifically those causal links might have been.
Sure. Yeah, great question, Matt. So my working thesis was this. It was books directly influenced Lincoln's military strategy and the institutional shift in civilian military leadership in the White House. So that's kind of like you have the simple but not easy task of figuring out what he read, why, and the impact. And then also kind of bringing relevance to the topic. So what? Here's what he read and this is what he did. But when you tell people about this research today, they go, great. Is this more than history? What, you know, as someone who's also interested in current affairs and national policy, I can show people that, yes, it did make a difference. I mean, it did kind of pave the way for the modern post-1947 paradigm we have now. So looking back historically and contextually, at the time there wasn't great precedent for the civilian leader to be commanding the military. So previous to the Civil War, we've obviously got the Revolutionary War. And a lot of people will be like, no, like Washington, he was the unifying figure, right? General Washington, President Washington. But what a lot of people don't realize is those roles weren't concurrent. And him serving as the general, you know, you'll always remember him signing letters, your obedient servant. And he's writing to, at the time, there were presidents under the Articles of Confederation who had no branch, let alone powers, to speak of. So that dynamic doesn't solve the problem that we faced in the Civil War. Also, in the War of 1812, you kind of see a fantastic survival of the United States. Madison, you know, sets the bar pretty low in terms of what's required of a presidential commander-in-chief at the time.
You know, basically, don't get conquered.
Yeah, and Madison has these great political axioms that are the core of the republic and require the consent of all the governed, et cetera, to the point where it doesn't fund the national defense. And he, as, you know, not a very polished military mind, practically has to step in at Bladensburg, where they lose. He practically gets captured retreating through the streets of D.C. and is without his family and home for a couple days. Where and like you're saying, bar is don't let an invading army march into D.C., eat your dinner off of the dinner table and burn it to the ground. And that's, you know, we can kind of laugh about that now, but in the 1860s, that's not forgotten. And so we talk about a lot of strategy and a lot of inertia. Defending Washington was a huge, huge priority. for some really understandable reasons if you look at the history.
So there's kind of that cultural background that's sort of playing on Lincoln's mind in terms of how he goes about prosecuting the war. But let's talk about the specific things that he read. So what in your research did you find were some of the case studies of clear examples where he read something and then he did something different, if you did in fact find that?
So as I'm going through the quite literal 16,000 book tower of books on Abraham Lincoln, so to speak, I found a couple of moments that I'd love to kind of briefly share, one of which is a title written by Henry Halleck, who at the time of writing in the 1840s is a first lieutenant in the Army, and the title is Elements of Military Art and Science, and the full title includes War Course of Instruction in Strategy, Fortification, Tactics of Battles, etc., Embracing the Duties of Staff, Infantry, Cavalry, Artillery, and Engineers, Adapted to the Use of Volunteers and Militia. So, I mean, that's...
back at a time when that was actually a sensible length for a book title.
Yeah.
It's a lot of words after a colon.
I don't know if it's flying off the shelves anywhere, but how I found that was going kind of right to the source to filter through all of these potential titles that I'm kind of finding in secondary sources. You can actually pull up the register at the Library of Congress and see what indeed was signed out to Abraham Lincoln, when it was checked out, and when it was returned, and this title was clearly written there. So huge shout out to the Library of Congress for having all of that available. I'm sure I'm not the first person to look at that page. It's well-worn.
And it would actually just be written, A. Lincoln.
Yeah. Well,
next to the book title.
He's got whole pages in each registry book of books that are checked out. So this is one of, one or 200 over the time where he's the president of books checked out. But I've got the title. Luckily, it's one of these cool books that you can get on Amazon for free. The digital world is amazing. And a quick read-through of it, I realized it was the perfect book for him to pick up. First of all, because of timing. So it was checked out on January 8th in 1862. Which is kind of that period that I was focusing on where it's been long enough where Lincoln's getting disconcerted. There's political and legal pressure on him as the commander-in-chief responsible for the armed forces. The Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War is kind of knocking on his door, and by January 6th, they've already met with him twice, and he's kind of given very embarrassing testimony to the effect of, my generals are running the war, and General McClellan's sick with typhoid and not taking calls, quite frankly. So that pressure on him, you can definitely kind of infer a connection there. He's like, oh, crap, someone go to the library, get me a book on this war thing. So reading through there, the first chapter is all about just war theory, legal basis for war. It doesn't jump right into the tactics. Lincoln served in the militia very briefly, so he knew very little about grand strategy, so to speak, of military arts and sciences. So this is a very palatable book for him, and I can picture him quite quickly kind of vacuuming up the material. Not lost also is that the author is now one of the senior commanders of his Western armies. First Lieutenant Henry Halleck becomes General Henry Old Brain Halleck, Old Brains Halleck.
Pretty good nickname.
Yeah, Old Brain. I mean, I think he took a little bit of pride in it, but it was definitely used in a derogatory sense.
And he would have been First Lieutenant then in the Mexican-American War, so 1848 time frame, so we're talking maybe a 18 to 20-year sort of variance on that?
Exactly, yeah. And this kind of gets to one of just the diagnoses of the United States military at the outbreak of the Civil War, which is very unprepared in terms of an experienced professional military. He's one of the senior people because he wrote a transport from the East Coast to the West Coast and translated a French military treatise. That was his major accomplishment of the war. And 20 years later, he's one of the senior generals. So taking that book on the one hand and knowing that Lincoln read it and making some assumptions on what he gathered from the book, and then also looking at quite a fantastic compilation of official records of the Civil War. There's a collection called The War of the Rebellion, and it has pretty much a complete record of telegrams sent, Union and Confederate sides. So doing a pretty rudimentary, analysis of language, you can kind of see Halleck kind of go, we would say in these days, VFR direct to Lincoln. So Lincoln's trying to make a push on the Western campaign, and Halleck actually pretty much cites this book that he wrote 20 years ago, talking about exterior lines failing 99 times out of 100, and Lincoln obviously has no idea what he's talking about and just goes, tell me what day you can advance on. And then 5 days later, on January 13th, so checks out the book on January 8th, 2 days earlier was that kind of telegram from Halleck saying, hey, let the war be a clash of the generals. Don't try to step in here. You're the president. You're not a general, let alone the general in chief. And then on January 13th, after he's kind of absorbed the book, Halleck's own book, actually. He writes to Halleck's senior general and uses the language perfectly and kind of gives a long concept of operations and commander's intent and says, here's what I see. These are this is the strategy I want you to utilize, and kind of, you know, in a very intellectual way, tells Halleck to, like, just do his job as it's written in the book that he wrote himself. And so I think that's a really telling example of, one, you know, the impact of the books that Lincoln read, and two, how it had a direct effect on how he ran the war.
Well, it's really interesting that you managed to sort of triangulate those different sources of both, the checkout records of the Library of Congress combined with the telegrams. And I guess that must be something that's pretty unique about the Civil War, because that's really the first American conflict where you actually have telegrams and you have that ability to sort of timestamp kind of, you know, different modes of thought that weren't either done ex post facto or done in really long letters, which odds are you probably are writing a few of those in the middle of the war.
Right. Well, and that's one of the great challenges and opportunities of studying the Civil War that I found is there's an explosion of kind of documentation. You know, so everyone talks about photographs. It's not the turn of the printing press, so to speak, but it just becomes a lot easier to kind of get published and have things written down and documented. It does provide a little bit of an obstacle when sorting through centuries-old biographies of Lincoln because, hey, someone wanted to write one and they could. Didn't have to be that good, quite frankly. But, yeah, exactly to your point, there's so much out there. And thanks to the digital age, a lot of these collections are digitized. You can do Boolean searches for things instead of being like Nicolas Cage paging through the library all night. You can kind of just do, like, you know, Control F, Lincoln, Halleck, go, and the Library of Congress kind of, you know, definitely gives you a lot of material, but it's a lot easier than carving out a month's time sorting through books.
So Halleck's book, that's one good data point. Mm-hmm. But there's more than one case study of Lincoln reading something and then doing something really interesting in the military sphere.
So there are, and there's plenty. It's well known that Lincoln, you know, kind of read everything that was put in front of him. And getting to the angle of how to efficiently write a thesis or write a capstone is, it's really easy to get sidetracked with all of those stories, and I can definitely share one or two of them here with you. But it was so important to constantly define and redefine the focus of my study. And I said, hey, I've got the registry from the Library of Congress. I know this is the title, and quite frankly, it's one of the only relevant titles checked out by the Library of Congress. I could go reading these five other books about the 100 other books that he read, but I won't graduate on time. But, I mean, there are a couple other ones. And actually, one that's included in the registry is the Constitution. This gets me thinking, you know, if there's a way to, you know, find out whenever the president checks out the Constitution from the Library of Congress, I'd like to know, because something's probably about to happen. So we see that when things are getting a little dicey, Lincoln checks out the Constitution, both copies of it that are in the library. I think there's one from the late 1700s and one from like 1823 that he checks out twice. And it's quite clear that he's using that, as well as a book titled The War Powers of the President, that is actually discovered by Painter, who paints the first reading of the Emancipation Proclamation, which is, you know, a huge painting that he was commissioned for 6 months to paint in the White House. He lives in the White House for 6 months, writes a book about it because he's got to sell books. He can only sell the painting once. He wants to sell copies of the book to make a living. And in that book is recorded a conversation between him and the president where he goes, hey, I noticed this book was always open in your office when I was painting things. You know, can you talk about it? Did it have an impact on your signing of the Emancipation Proclamation in the book? Sure. Why, of course it did. It was a great help. And he actually paints the title onto a book, kind of one of the artifacts of the painting. There's maps and the Constitution, and there's like a book leaning against a chair, and he actually goes in and writes on the spine of the book in the painting, War Powers of the President by William Whiting. So reading through that book now, you can clearly see how Lincoln goes in his first inaugural from, I will not change the Constitution, I will not change the law, I will respect the rights of property. And his first inaugural is pretty much reads like a legal analysis of his own constraints of the power of the presidency. How do you go from there to the Civil War, to the Emancipation Proclamation, let alone the 13th Amendment? So the War Powers of the President is connected to the Emancipation Proclamation, and his checking out, if you will, of the U.S. Constitution from the Library of Congress is tied to the 13th Amendment. So just a couple weeks after the 13th Amendment is put forth on the Senate floor and the language is kind of solidified. The votes have not happened and the states have not ratified it yet. That's when he returns the copies of the Constitution. And so I thought that was quite interesting as well.
So while we mentioned returning, I guess one thing we haven't mentioned yet is about how story about returning. So returning a book is important. What happened with Halleck?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. The book Halleck wrote, I mean, has a lot of chapters, only one or two of which are on strategy and tactics. He's a very academic and administrative man, and he's the general-in-chief of the Army before Grant, who ends up actually kind of gaining the ultimate favor and respect of President Lincoln. So Lincoln probably, as he's, you know, staring at this book, realizes there's a lot of good change that can come about from this administrative business, so to speak. There's like four chapters on army organization. He goes, why is this guy my general-in-chief? I've got to make this position called general chief of staff, which is also prescribed in the book. General Halleck is a student of Napoleon, and he's always kind of complaining about how the Union armies are not structured like their European counterparts. So Lincoln goes, sure, we'll have a chief of staff. It'll be you. And who better suited for it than you, who's the writer of this text? And
so he wrote a book prescribing the creation of a position that he ended up later filling.
Yeah, albeit being demoted to that position. and kind of Grant passes over him. And Grant served under him in the West early in the war. And after his great victory at Vicksburg, you know, he kind of ends up superseding Halleck and successfully pursuing the war, especially in Lincoln's mind, for the rest of the Civil War. And then, of course, just after that move, Lincoln returns the copy of Halleck's book to the Library of Congress.
So thanks for all the work that you've done. I'm demoting you, and I'm returning your book. I've learned everything I need.
And just one other thing, too, about the book. It wasn't kind of written as a novel or a handbook by General Halleck. It was actually originally a series of lectures given up in Boston, at the Lowell Institute. It was kind of opportunistically published as a book when it was evident that war was approaching and a huge mobilization of the Union Army was going to be required. There wasn't a standard machine that we have now that is constantly ready for a conflict. There was quite literally armies had to be raised whenever a conflict broke out. That's kind of the context of Halleck's book. He wasn't, you know, oh, I'll write a book about this. He was kind of preaching to potential, you know, militia or regular army leaders. And then when things got really serious, someone goes, we need to distribute this wider than your lectures. So that's how it became a book. And I think it's really easy to kind of getting to the current relevance of that. You look online, there's a lot of, you know, great to read, you know, literature, including SimSec, Sea Control podcasts, lots of blogs on national defense and et cetera. And those are the Lowell Institute lectures of our time, so to speak. So this is kind of, you know, not just encouragement, but a warning. You know, if you are publishing or putting ideas out there, you never know when the president's going to, you know, scroll over to your podcast and listen to something and fire somebody or hire somebody. And so just keep that in the back of your mind. That's all I have to say.
Well, thanks for making me self-conscious about the podcast. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So now that I know that the president is listening, it seems like a lot of the attention that the Civil War normally gets seems to focus mostly on the land campaigns, you know, your Gettysburgs and Vicksburgs and whatnot. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, your topic and how it fits into what went down in Hampton Roads.
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, you know, always bring it back to sea control. The Monitor and the Merrimack, you know, are is the one kind of naval thing that always jumps out, if not the Trent Affair, the seizure of the Confederate diplomats on their way to Great Britain. So a lot is made, and kind of everything naval is made of the Monitor and Merrimack engagement, and everyone knows that it happened, and they just kind of shot at each other for a while, and then it ended in a draw, and they both went home. What's less known and ties into the emergence of civilian military leadership in the war is how the Merrimack, the Confederate ironclad, how it was destroyed. And it wasn't by some grand naval clash where the Union forces could overcame it. It was by very direct executive leadership, I'll say. President Lincoln is really perturbed with a lot of things, but the fact that this one ironclad is kind of bottling up merchant and military shipping around Hampton Roads, he's pretty pissed. So he gets his Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary Chase, and they sail down or steam down on a United States revenue cutter, which is part of the Department of the Treasury at the time. So this is Secretary Chase's boat. He's kind of like in charge of his little navy of revenue cutters, and they sail down the Potomac, and they stop at Fort Monroe, which is kind of at the mouth of Hampton Roads, and they talk with the general in charge there, General Wool, and he goes, well, we've been trying to, you know, effect a landing on Norfolk, and it's been impossible. We haven't been able to do it. And Secretary Chase goes out with Miami in a tugboat, and he kind of pokes around, and Lincoln stares at maps, which he's been doing ever since the Battle of Bull Run. He's been obsessed with maps and understanding terrain, which is key for military leaders, and one of three great truths that he discovers in simplifying and understanding the Civil War is that the generals who don't know the terrain can't do anything right. And so he's constantly trying to learn from maps. So he does the map study. You got the Secretary of the Treasury doing a leader's recon on, you know, Norfolk. And Secretary Chase says, hey, President Lincoln, I think I found an alternate landing site. They go in this revenue cutter, and they go with the Secretary of War as well. So it's not a general, but the civilian leader of the War Department goes with him. Lincoln and Secretary Stanton go in a tugboat and, you know, kind of walk on the beach, walk on the sovereign soil, the sacred soil of Virginia, as Chase is kind of directing the guns of the Miami, the revenue cutter, protecting him. And Lincoln returns and says, see, like, go here, land the army there. The next night they do. Secretary Chase accepts the surrender of Norfolk, and Lincoln is moving on with other things as he hears the ironclad Merrimack explode as it's destroyed in the harbor. And that's, you know, in one, you know, 5-day period, how President Lincoln and his civilian team just kind of cut through the cultural barrier that existed in the profession of arms. And by the end of the war, it's very clear if you try to get in President Lincoln's way, he'll just make you look stupid.
So our time is running short. So before we finish up, again, as is Sea Control tradition, what kind of things have you been reading lately? So not just for your capstone, although you've already talked about some great works that have kind of inspired the, you know, what you're working on, but what sort of things have you been reading recently in general that have sort of captured your imagination and attention?
I recently finished From the Shadows, so the first memoir of Secretary Gates. A lot of people are familiar with Duty, but before he wrote Duty and before he was SecDef, he already did his memoir when he thought his, you know, government career was over and very accomplished as it was.
That was when he was CIA director.
Yeah, CIA. I mean, he had a lot of different jobs under a lot of different administrations, whether it's the national security decision-making apparatus or the intelligence community. But there's a lot of really good commentary on objective perspectives on history. I think that is a great read, kind of in the same vein as my studies on Lincoln. Also reading kind of more recent Wanzerati's Treasury's War, and, you know, talk about unsung heroes, civilian control or civilian government leadership. I mean, that's the whole sanctions movement. I mean, it's not a new idea, but the way it's been enforced has made a huge impact, you know, since September 11, 2001.
Well, again, thanks, Maddie, for being with us today. Best of luck, you know, finishing off your thesis, and hopefully we'll be able to get some of the people listening to this podcast today to take a look at it.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I'd love that. That'd be great. Thanks for having me.